Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're opening the show today circling back with the director of the Housatonic Resources Recovery Authority, or HRRA, to learn more about how that agency is transforming a successful pilot program promoting glass recycling to include the authority's entire region, and how bringing the program statewide can make a huge and positive environmental impact. Then we'll catch up with a primary researcher from Griffin Hospital who will talk about the proven health benefits of extra virgin olive oil. Is it time you included extra virgin olive oil in your diet to promote cardiovascular health? Stay tuned and find out. And we'll wrap with a representative from Connecticut's AARP leadership who's reaching out to community groups and municipal agencies across the state, reminding them that it's time to apply for the 2021 Livable Communities Grant Program, a local extension of the National AARP Community Challenge Grant Initiative to help the state's neighborhoods, towns, and cities be great places to live for people of all ages. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Items ranging from fine art to fun experiences will be up for bid during the Boots and Britches virtual auction September 20th to October 4th. All proceeds from the event benefit Little Britches Therapeutic Riding, a local nonprofit that helps kids and adults with special needs discover their strengths through horseback riding. Little Britches, based in Roxbury, relies on grants, donations, and fundraising events to keep riders' fees affordable. And some 80 students from towns throughout northwestern Connecticut currently participate. To check out all the auction items or to learn more about participating or supporting this nonprofit, visit littlebritchesct.org. Well, as promised, we are back with Jennifer Heaton-Jones. She is Executive Director of the HRRA, the Housatonic Resources Recovery Authority. And that agency, as you have heard here before on the award-winning For the People, is a regional governmental waste management and recycling authority serving 14 municipalities in Western Connecticut and a population of over 250,000 people. There are similar agencies serving regions across the state of Connecticut, but as you've heard on a couple previous segments with Jennifer, HRRA has been very proactive in the Department of Glass Recycling. Our interview with Jen about two and a half years ago, when you introduced the, or were about to introduce the pilot, and then we caught up with you mid-pandemic about how the pilot was going, and now there's really exciting news to announce coming off the heels of a press conference that you just did. So we'll talk about all that, but first, beyond that quick introduction, Jen, remind people what HRRA and similar authorities across the state do.
Well, thank you and good morning. Thank you for having me again. And the HRRA, as you had mentioned, is a regional governmental solid waste and recycling authority. Pretty much our mission is to help municipalities work together to solve the region's solid waste disposal problems and maximize the efficiency and the value of the state's recycling programs. And now we're bringing back glass recycling to its fullest.
Excellent. Well, before we get into talking about the press conference and converting the pilot to a region-wide initiative, there's a lot of other stuff that HRRA and your kind of sister authorities across the state of Connecticut do. You're a huge resource to businesses and residents on how to legally, appropriately, and in an environmentally friendly way, get rid of a lot of stuff that they don't want. So let's talk a little bit about recycling and disposal. And then we want to remind people also about the important benefits of composting. But let's start. You've got a recycling event coming up in Brookfield, right?
We do. Well, we have a household hazardous waste event. It will be on September 11th from 9 to 2 p.m. at Brookfield High School for any resident of the HRRA region of any of the 14 member municipalities. And that is a program that we provide six times a year for residents to properly dispose of, you know, household cleaners, pesticides, herbicides, maybe pool chemicals, maybe you have a few gallons of paint left over in your garage or in your basement, and that you kept thinking you're going to hold on to for that patch job, and you
it's
never
now
got
a lump
to
of
it. So.
White clay.
Yes, but we wanted, actually, a lot of folks believe that the old way was putting kitty litter in your paint container to dry it out. We don't want you to do that anymore. We want it in liquid form because we now recycle our paint through Paint Care. Paint Care is an EPR program through the state of Connecticut, and we are proud to provide that resource to our residents. So if you want to, it is actually recycling. So the household hazardous waste, there are fuel blends, and it's reblended and used, or some things are incinerated, and then there are other items that are recycled, such as paint.
And once again, it's important to note that if folks don't live in the region that HRRA serves, which is up in the kind of the New Milford, Bridgewater, Brookfield, you also serve Danbury, Kent, Newtown, Reading, Ridgefield, Sherman, Weston, and Wilton, certainly in many of our radio station listening areas. There are other similar authorities across the state of Connecticut, and they conduct their own exact same activities, right?
Correct. And anyone listening that may not be a part of the HRA can go to the Connecticut DEEP website and search household hazardous waste, and you'll get a list of locations and dates for their hometown.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your HRRA recycling events for hazardous waste, are you finding that a lot of people are showing up with stuff that they can't recycle at a hazardous waste drop-off event?
So are you asking if they bring material?
Yeah, are there typical?
Are
we just to warn people what not to bring if there are frequent incidents of people showing up with stuff that they're then going back home with because it's not really appropriate for these events?
Yes. So, you know, we only take household hazardous waste from residential homes. And typically the items that we don't accept, we only don't accept them because they are accepted at a local drop-off. So your own local transfer station / recycling center will take, let's say, motor oil or antifreeze.
Oh, okay. Like every day.
Or every day or propane tanks. So to reduce our cost at the event, these events cost anywhere between $40,000 to $60,000 for the day. Mm-hmm. It's all based on the number of cars and the material that everyone is bringing in. So to reduce the cost, and it is paid for by tax dollars, we want you to dispose of it where you can at a lower cost.
Very good.
However, that being said, typically when someone brings in items, we don't turn them away. We want to make it easy and convenient for our residents. But we ask them to look at the list of what is accepted and what isn't accepted before coming to the event. And that is all posted on our website at HRRA.
And you certainly don't want them to have that other stuff magically disappear out of the vehicle between being refused at the hazardous waste drop-off and back home, of course. So word to the wise. Yes, HRRA.org, I interrupted Jen from saying, is the website if you live in one of the northwestern regional communities that they serve. So how about composting? This is a huge thing, and I swear on social networks, people talk about what streaming service series they're binge watching, and I think the second or third most popular thing is composting. How does HRRA get involved in that?
Well, we're excited to be one of the first in the state several years ago to provide a curbside collection in the town of Bridgewater, which was a pilot. And that transitioned to five local municipal drop-off programs, including in the town of Newtown. And, our hope and desire is that we can address the waste crisis in the state of Connecticut. And being that 30% or more of our solid waste, of the everyday trash that our residents are throwing away, is organics. It's food scraps. And why should we be incinerating something that's mostly water and it's not efficient to burn? So waste to energy plants are designed to burn our trash and create energy, and it's put into the grid. What's more efficient with our food scraps is composting. And so we ask our residents that learn about backyard composting. HRA provides backyard composting classes. We do it currently virtually, and hopefully in the near future back in person. If you have your fears of backyard composting and have all these ideas what it may or may not be, you're afraid of animals or insects and the bears are going to come, we will help you create a compost pile that will prevent that from happening. And in the end, if you don't want a backyard compost, well, we have these drop-off programs where you can fill a container and drop it off any day of the week that the facility is open. And then last, there are a few haulers in the HRRA region that provide curbside collection. So you can go to the HRRA website and find which haulers are registered to do business, and they offer that service so that we can reduce the amount of trash that we are sending to waste to energy.
Well, that's awesome. If you're just joining us, Jennifer Heaton-Jones is back on the program. She is with the Housatonic Resources Recovery Authority, a regional waste authority. We're talking a little bit about some of the other important work that they do, but let's switch gears to the main event. You guys just came off the heels of a press conference where you made a big announcement about something we've been talking about on this program for probably over 2 years now, and that is glass recycling. Tell us the latest.
Well, we have taken our pilot phase, which where we just had a few drop-off locations in the region where residents who were utilizing the transfer stations were separating their glass there. Now we are asking all of the residents of the entire region of all 14 towns to voluntarily begin to separate their glass from the mixed recycling stream so that we can ensure that it's actually getting recycled. Glass is a state-mandated recyclable, and decades ago, it was always being recycled. But in the last 10 years, because of mixed recycling, or some call it single-stream recycling, it's been sent to landfills 500 miles out of the state of Connecticut, used for alternate daily cover. And the problem isn't the glass. The problem is how we collect it and handle it. So we want to change that. We want to ask people, we want to recapture the value of glass and ensure it's getting recycled into new products by recycling it separately.
So now all of the towns within the HRRA region will be asked to voluntarily separate recycling. So what does that mean in the behavior of the average homeowner who is already putting everything into one big container for either a municipal pickup or a paid service to come and do it?
So, I mean, it's not much different than what you're already doing. You're still going to continue to mix all your other recyclables, your metal, your paper, and your plastics. We're just asking to keep the glass separate. And for now, you can bring it to a drop-off. Every town has a glass container at their local transfer station. The town of Brookfield and Sherman have it at a municipal location. And you can either mix the glass in your kitchen, let's say, and you have one container because you don't want another container in your kitchen taking up space. And maybe you have a sorting space in your garage where you take that glass out. Mm-hmm. Or you take all your mixed recycling down to your transfer station, and there you can separate it out. But eventually, we want the glass to be separate. If you have a private hauler who comes to your home weekly, you can ask that private hauler if they are willing to offer that as a service. We do have some small private haulers in the region who are already offering that as a service. So they're collecting mixed recycling on a regular basis, and once a month they'll pick up your glass separate. So that's pretty much, not much will change except separating your glass.
Mm. So now this has gone public across the entire HRRA region, but do you know of other municipalities or entire resource regions that are either eyeing HRRA's successful program to adapt it into their practices in the near future, or are already doing it?
Yes, so I have several municipalities have reached out to me in the last several months asking how can they do what we're doing. They see the value in ensuring that the glass is being recycled into a new product, either into an industrial filler for cement or into bottle-to-bottle or fiberglass, rather than what's happening to it now. And there's a cost advantage as well, and it's much more sustainable. So we do have towns from the town of Orange to the town of Fairfield calling and asking what can they do to join the effort.
Hmm. And as we get close to saying farewell to you for this segment, Jennifer, can you just remind folks what the environmental benefit is? Because maybe 10 or 15 years ago, either the way that they manufactured glass or the way they disposed of it doesn't have environmental impact like it does today.
Well, glass is 100% recyclable infinitely. And when it is separated, it's more pure, it has more value. And when it is mixed in the single stream recycling system, it almost never gets recycled. And it is, like I had mentioned before, shipped 500 miles out of the state of Connecticut. So just the carbon footprint of transportation alone, it has a significant change when we're doing it local. So the glass is going to be recycled in the state of Connecticut, lower footprint on transportation. Mm. I think the other thing that's important for residents to consider and think about, and there's more information, by the way, on our website regarding this whole program. But I think what's really important for residents to, one, remember, we separated our glass and all of our material many, many years ago. This isn't something that's really new. Single stream recycling is new, but separating our glass and our other items is not new. And so we're just asking folks to go back to the way we did it once before to capture this material, because it is recyclable when it is separate. It is not as recyclable when it's in the mixed stream. Mm. And so we're reducing our carbon footprint. It's less energy to recycle glass into new glass bottles than it is to take the natural resources that we need to create glass, soda ash, limestone, and there's a lot of sand. So a lot of natural resources are used to create glass, and we can replace that and the need to deplete resources from the earth by using recycled material.
And in closing, what about the way we put glass into our recycling separate container? Does the glass have to be squeaky clean?
We just ask folks to rinse the bottles out and remove the caps. You do not need to remove the labels. Just we ask for the caps and lids to be removed to reduce the contamination.
Yeah.
But it's that simple, and it's okay if they break. Breaking is okay. We just want it to just be glass. And it's really important that the residents know that we are talking about food and beverage glass containers and jars.
Your mom's old, Ronald McDonald kitchen glasses set, right?
Right. We don't want drinking glasses, mirrors, ceramic cups, plates, window glass, etc. We just want glass containers that contain food and beverage.
Consumer containers.
It's pretty simple. A few steps. Rinse your glass containers, remove the lids, place it in a separate container, and either drop it off or ask your hauler to pick it up. We hope that it will be easy and convenient.
Excellent. Jennifer Heaton-Jones is Executive Director of the Housatonic Resource Recovery Authority, HRRA, serving more than a dozen towns and 250,000 people in Western and Northwestern Connecticut. HRRA.org is their website to refresh yourself on any of the information you heard here on the program today. Congratulations, Jennifer, on taking glass recycling region-wide and being such a great resource to the communities you serve, as well as the entire state of Connecticut. Hopefully, we'll see your HRRA glass recycling program statewide very soon. Thanks for being on the program. Well, it's been quite a long time since we talked to our friends at the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in Derby, and I'm so excited to receive the information about research that has recently been conducted by the center that found some very interesting information that we hope will benefit the health of everybody that's listening and that you'll tell your friends about it. A little study involving extra virgin olive oil that made some actual improvements in the marker for cardiovascular health, while refined olive oil did not. So maybe you're the kind of person that gets up in the morning and drinks a shot glass of extra virgin olive oil. Maybe you don't even think about it when you're sprinkling it on your salad or using it in your cooking. But we are here with our new friend, Dr. Valentine Zeki with the center. We'll call him Val. And Val, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John. Nice meeting you.
So before we talk about the study, tell us a little bit about the individuals that were working with you on it.
Oh, good. Thank you, John. I mean, first we had Dr. David Katz, who was actually the center director. He actually was part of this study and has actually moved on during the process of this study to go and kind of like continue some of his innovation that he actually has developed during the years. And we have a new center PI now that is called Dr. Fares. Dr. Fares Escamilla, who is a professor in the Yale School of Public Health. The funding of this study was provided to us by Cobran Estate, which is an olive oil company that is based in California and Australia.
So in terms of your involvement with the study, tell us a little bit about yourself. Are you a cardiologist or a researcher? Or what is your area of specialty?
I am a researcher with a medical background. I've been doing a lot of research on cardiometabolic health. I was the principal investigator of this study.
Oh, very good. Well, for folks that may not be familiar with the incredible work that's been going on now for so long right down there in Derby at the center, just give them a little bit of background.
Well, the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center is one of the 26 research centers that is actually funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Disease Prevention, CDC. It has been here in Griffin for now since 1998. Is actually affiliated with the School of Public Health. We conduct a lot of research on cardiovascular health, looking at different elements like food, like supplement, how it affects the cardiovascular health of the individuals with different populations. We also do what we call community-based participatory research, which is geared toward improving the health or improving disparity in areas where there is need in our local community, where we are doing it here in New Haven and also in Naugatuck Valley.
Very good. So you recently published the results of this study on olive oil and cardiovascular health in a medical journal. Hasn't there already been a lot of research done between olive oil and extra virgin olive oil?
Yes, there have been a lot of research already done, previously done on this topic. But the conclusion that actually came out of this research was kind of like, we would say kind of inconclusive. The major reason because they did not specify what type of olive oil that we used to conduct the study. That has been the problem now. And if you look, go to the supermarket, just like a consumer hearing this and go to the supermarket, you will see a variety of olive oil in front of them. You will see like pure, light, or you could see like classic. You see virgin and extra virgin olive oil in front of them.
Yeah. And I remember probably a little over a decade ago, there was quite a controversy because what was being labeled as extra virgin olive oil, I guess when the inspectors and the scientists got into it, they found out that some of what was being represented as extra virgin olive oil wasn't exactly correct.
Well, that was a big scandal that actually happened. That investigation was carried on in Italy and France. As a matter of fact, they said almost as close to 50% of the extra virgin oil that's labeled, that's the Italian extra virgin oil that is labeled as extra virgin olive oil, were really not. There were kind of like several reasons that these, they were kind of like manipulating it. They actually consider it was like some kind of like a mafia that was going on. They call it the agro mafia, a $16 billion enterprise that was actually going on in Italy when it comes to olive oil. Olive oils are actually processed differently. So what they were doing now in counterfeiting this was actually utilizing different, like the Italian extra virgin olive oil, mix it together with the North African extra virgin olive oil with some other Mediterranean brand of low quality.
Oh, I see. So it was kind of tainting the purity?
Yes, that was actually tainting the purity of the olive oil.
Oh, I see. And just all for the bottom line, to stretch the extra virgin or the premium, most expensive, a little bit longer.
That's correct.
Very good. Well, tell us, educate us. What is the difference? You said you named all these different kinds of olive oils. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is actually the way they're actually being processed, bottled, and actually transported. If you see like the extra virgin oil, the extra virgin olive oil, what happened to this is during the processing is actually they just have to do like the grinding of the fruits, of the olive fruits. And then they use the pressing process to actually extract the oil from the olives. Okay, now, during that process, they don't use any heat to do the extraction, or they don't add any solvent there to do the extraction. So it's pure that exact fruit that you actually get out, get extract the oil from without using anything or not adding any additive in it. That is actually the extra virgin. And the goals to determine this go through a two-phase. The biochemical property of it, and the second phase is actually through the taste. And if you taste it, it actually tastes like the olive, the mature green olive itself. When you talk about the virgin olive oil, is the virgin of it is actually a lower grade. It's a little bit lower grade. Also, there's no additive. It's extra virgin oil. But the difference is with extra virgin is it has some degree of acidity, and the aroma and the flavor has been defected a little bit. Any other thing that is below these is actually considered refined. That could be either pure or light. Don't get confused with the light, because light, you may think that basically light means low in fat or low in calorie. It's actually low in actually the olive itself.
Oh, I see. So in terms of extra virgin olive oil, there's the heightened antioxidant quality?
Yes, they have a lot. They have more beneficial nutrients that are actually good for cardiovascular health. These are actually the polyphenols and the antioxidants that are actually loaded in these. During the processing, like the refinement of olive oil, they lose these biochemical properties. That is why the refined one then tend not to give us more benefit as the extra virgin olive oil.
Oh, okay. Well, we just want to take a quick break, Dr. Dziki. We appreciate your information. We're talking with Dr. Valentine Dziki. He is a researcher with the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in Derby, and we're talking about some brand new information that is emerging about the health benefits of extra virgin olive oil in your diet. We'll be back to talk more about that and how this study rolled out and what they actually found and how consuming extra virgin olive oil might be able to help your health. We'll be right back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Governor Ned Lamont and Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz are inviting members of the public to attend Connecticut's annual 9/11 Memorial Ceremony, honoring and celebrating the lives of those killed in the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. This year's ceremony will be held at 5:30 p.m. on Thursday, September 9th at Sherwood Island State Park in Westport. Family members of those who were killed in the attacks will participate, and the names of the 161 victims with ties to Connecticut will be read aloud. For those who cannot attend in person, it's anticipated that the Connecticut Network will stream the ceremony live at ct-n.com, and a video will also be posted on the website for later viewing shortly after the ceremony's conclusion. So come out and celebrate and remember those lost on 9/11 on Thursday, September 9th at Sherwood Island State Park at 5:30 p.m. Well, we're back with Dr. Valentine Nizicki with the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center in Derby, who has just participated and helped author a study that found that extra virgin olive oil improved certain markers for cardiovascular health, while refined olive oil did not. So, Dr. Nizicki, I understand that your olive oil study compared the health effects of two types of olive oils in adults who were at risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So I guess we should start the second half of our show just clarifying what the connection is between diabetes and cardiovascular health.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, diabetes, when you kind of like develop diabetes or at risk of diabetes, it puts you at higher risk of developing cardiovascular event. Kind of like you could have like easily have like a heart attack or something. So we actually did a study. With this study, we kind of like look at those individuals. They were considered like pre-diabetes or at risk for diabetes, let's say it this way, that contain like the pre-diabetes and also those with metabolic syndrome. Pre-diabetes are those with a little bit elevated blood glucose level that is higher than normal, but not high enough to be considered diabetes. And they are about 88 million of adults in the United States, based on the CDC estimate, with this condition. Yet, only 1 in 10 individuals is aware that they have this condition. Why? The metabolic syndrome is actually a cluster of syndrome that contain metabolic panels that actually, they put this person also at risk. If you have certain number of this risk factor, you go at risk of like more likely to develop type 2 diabetes. These were the individual that we studied.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how the study rolled out. What were the mechanics of it, and how did you get the participants, into the research?
Yeah, we recruited 20 individuals who meet our criteria for either pre-diabetes or metabolic syndrome, and now created a smoothie with the extra virgin olive oil or the refined olive oil, and I gave them to consume. They consume it within like 10 to 15 minutes in front of us just to make sure, we ensure that they comply. And then before actually doing that, we actually measure their caliber of their blood vessel using what we call the high-frequency ultrasound to get a sense of the beginning, before they ingested anything, what the size of the caliber of their blood vessel was in the arm. And then after they consumed, 2 hours later, we went back again and remeasure the caliber of the blood vessel again to see if it has actually caused any change in the size of the caliber of the blood vessel. We also measure the blood pressure in the same manner before and after they ingested the olive oil in their smoothie. We found that after 2 hours of ingestion, those who consume extra virgin olive oil showed improvement in their blood vessel by dilatation. It actually improved. So it improved the elasticity. So the hardening became less. So more blood could, flow through the blood vessels. And that was the improvement that we see. Meanwhile, those who actually were consuming the refined olive oil, we did not find any benefit. As in regards to the blood pressure, neither oil showed any beneficial effect on blood pressure.
Okay. So you mentioned that there were 20 subjects for this specific study. At this point, do you take the information that you have and have published in the hopes that you will be able to get funding to maybe have 200 people for a future study?
That is the goal. I mean, this is pretty small studies, yes, as we have to be cautious as we interpret the result. Yes, with the hope is actually to get a much larger study, maybe multi-site, because that actually improves our generalizability, to kind of like see if we could actually replicate the same finding in the context of a larger study.
So what's your take-home message to folks as they're listening to all this, complicated and scientific information about good old extra virgin olive oil?
Well, I mean, take-home message is that when actually making a decision on what type of olive oil, it depends on actually the type and the quality of the olive oil, as we actually seen or we actually talk about initially. Those that are actually kind of like extra virgin of good quality and have all the polyphenols and the antioxidant, they are good for our cardiovascular health. Why? Those that basically they have lost their biochemical property as a result of the processing, they are not as good as the extra virgin olive oil.
So do your conclusions apply to all extra virgin olive oils?
Not really all extra virgin oils. I would just say that in general, if the oil, virgin oil is labeled with extra virgin olive oil and the content of that extra virgin oil, olive oil is the same as actually labeled, that there is no problem. Yes, that extra virgin oil will more likely to have all the polyphenol and will give us that benefit. But if it is labeled and they have that deception like what we have in like Italy, that basically 50% of what was labeled extra virgin olive oil is not really extra virgin olive oil, then we have to be careful not to fall into that temptation. And in that segment in 60 Minutes that was done, and that says 50% of the olive oil in Italy were mislabeled or not labeled appropriately. And that is the same segment by Bill Whitaker, who aired that investigation, said that 75 to 80% of the extra virgin olive oil in the United States as well, they actually counterfeited.
So if somebody's hearing this program or hearing about it and they're saying, okay, well, it can't hurt to be ingesting some extra virgin olive oil, so that's all I'm going to buy from now on, and I'm going to be using it in my cooking and maybe even putting it in my smoothie. If they're doing that, is there some way that they can best ensure, if the product is properly labeled, that the extra virgin olive oil that they're purchasing and consuming maintains its optimal chemistry?
Well, good question. Well, I mean, I don't know if you're able to say that it's properly labeled if you are not like an expert in actually doing it and doing the test, for instance, because it's actually through a two process. It's through the biochemical, and you will not have the tool to do the biochemical analysis. And then the test, I mean, if you are not an expert, because only experts, they're actually able to determine the taste of the flavor, the aroma, and the acidity. So you will not be able to tell if it's actually really extra virgin olive oil. But what you can do is, like my advice would be kind of like, if you're buying like a product that is coming like from the United States, like maybe from California, it would be much beef to your advantage, because olive oil, the issue here is it may go transform as a result of excessive light exposure. So during the transportation from like Italy, assume that it was even a good one, not actually counterfeited one, maybe during that transportation, its overexposure to light may actually transform the biochemical property, and these polyphenols will lose their activity. So it's better to actually kind of like buy the one that is actually produced in California. And secondly, when you go to the supermarket, you want to look where in the supermarket where that the olive oil was placed. If it was placed in an area where there was too much exposure to light, you want to avoid buying those. You want to buy those that are actually not like in areas that are too much bright light or sunlight that is exposing to the oil.
Okay.
And also when you buy it, you take it home, you don't want to overexpose it also to light because you actually destroy the biochemical properties.
Okay. So as you said, it's difficult for the average consumer to be able to actually know if the olive oil, the extra virgin olive oil they're buying is authentic. But what about if they purchase the type of olive oil that you folks used in your study?
Well, yeah, that's it. That is one that we tested. If they purchase that one, yes. I mean, and that is coming also from California. It is more likely to have all those benefits that we actually observe in our study.
Very good. Well, we appreciate all the time explaining your study and your work, Dr. Dziki. We want to remind folks that the Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center offers a number of different studies that are taking place, and you could learn more about this organization by going to their website Doctor, could you provide the website for our listeners, please?
YaleGriffinPRC.org.
Very good. We thank you for your time this morning and all of this explanation, and wish you best of luck, hopefully, in the next phase of the extra virgin olive oil studies, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
So as we said in our introduction, we're circling back to talk with Anna Doragazi. She's a representative of AARP Connecticut. You know, AARP is the nation's largest nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to empowering people 50 and older to choose how they live as they age. But part of living well as you age is being part of a ultimately livable community. And Connecticut really is a national leader in establishing livable community initiatives under AARP. And we're so glad to be back with you, Anna. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Thanks so much for having me today.
Great. Well, we're going to talk about the next round of grant applications for the 2021 Livable Communities Grant Program, which, as we mentioned in our intro, is a local extension of the National AARP Community Challenge Grant Initiative. But first, AARP has also had a very active sequence of agendas in front of the Connecticut legislature in 2021. Was no different. How did you guys fare this year in terms of a couple of your biggest initiatives?
Sure. So it was a really interesting year in terms of the legislature because all of their business was conducted remotely. So we, you know, like every other advocacy organization and all of the residents in Connecticut, had to figure out how to navigate a virtual legislative session because of COVID. But despite some of the challenges and opportunities that came along with that, we were able to successfully advocate on behalf of a handful of issues that I think really matter to AARP members and all older adults. So one big area of focus for us in 2020 and heading into 2021 was related to nursing homes and long-term care. So, you know, as I'm sure everybody's very familiar at this point, COVID-19 was especially devastating for nursing home residents. That was one of the spots where we saw a lot of sickness and death very early on in the pandemic before
yeah.
folks really understood, you know, what was going on. So we worked with the state long-term care ombudsman, residents, family members to advocate for a handful of important reforms that include things like enhancing infection control procedures at nursing homes, requiring nursing homes to maintain a 2-month stockpile of personal protective equipment, increasing staffing levels. So residents need to receive at least 3 hours of direct care per resident per day. So a lot of really sensible common sense reforms that we think are going to lead to better care overall and hopefully, you know, make our state a little more resilient in case of future public health emergencies.
Excellent. You also have some important events, and I guess there's one coming up that's tied to the 2021 Livable Communities Grant Program. What can you tell people about that?
Sure. So our AARP National Office is hosting an event. It's a free online event that's going to take place on September 22nd and September 23rd. It's just an online workshop called Engaging Older Adults, Why It's Good for the Community. It's just a good opportunity for anyone who is interested in exploring this idea of livable communities and maybe having a better understanding of why, you know, it's really good to have active and engaged older adults and to make sure that our communities appeal to folks of all ages. You know, we focus a lot on attracting young people to our communities and our cities, but it's also really important to engage our older residents. So for folks who want to learn more about that, you can go to aarp.org/livable2021, LIVABLE2021.
Excellent. So in terms of the AARP Community Challenge Grants and how they kind of overarch the Connecticut Livable Communities Grant Program, let's talk a little bit about that dynamic, because don't I recall that Connecticut actually has had a couple of awards in the National Community Challenge Grant Program in the past 5 years or so?
That's true. So our state-level Livable Communities Grant is based on our national AARP Community Challenge Grant, which this year I think they awarded almost 250 grantees throughout the U.S. This year there were a handful of grantees right here in Connecticut. Some good projects coming out of that national grant. Groundwork Bridgeport, which is an organization that AARP Connecticut has worked with before, was awarded funding for a series of walking events. It's going to pair older adults and local teens to encourage, you know, fitness and intergenerational connections.
Yeah.
One of our great partners in Hartford, you know, Hartford Athletics Green and Blue Foundation is going to be doing some work, you know, right in the neighborhood of their stadium over at Dillon Stadium in Hartford. Tallinn Conservation Commission is going to be working on some walking trails and a labyrinth for the community to enjoy. So that's all coming out of our national community challenge grant.
Mm.
And then on the state level, our Livable Communities grant, which is in its fourth year, awards typically smaller grant amounts. Our maximum award this year is $5,000. And we really are looking for nonprofit organizations and towns and cities, government entities within Connecticut to apply with what we call quick action projects. So, you know, we're not going to, you know, repave your roads or build you an entire new building.
Sure.
But we want organizations and communities to be really thoughtful and creative about what is a small intervention that we can make that might make our community more appealing to folks, whether they're, you know, 2 years old or 100 years old or anywhere in between.
Mm. Well, as your Boston State Director Nora Duncan and our good friend here on For the People said in the announcement of this round of grants, small changes really make a big difference. And a lot of these ideas are coming out of that convergence of young creatives and community-minded people, mixing it up with some of the middle-aged and older population in their communities. Can you give a couple of examples of how, over the past 4 years, some of your Livable Communities grant recipients really did take just a few hundred or a few thousand dollars and made a huge difference or created a project that has had legs and longevity in their neighborhood or community?
Sure. So one of our 2020 grantees has a project that, you know, personally, as somebody who really enjoys biking in my community, The Groton Library Circle of Friends received funding in 2020 for what they call the Library Book Bike. So it's a custom-built tricycle with an attached trailer box that can hold 600 pounds of library items. So, you know, books, brochures, pamphlets, flyers, you name it. And they are bringing the library out into the community with this custom-built, you know, cargo tricycle, which I think is just the coolest thing and a great way for, a really important community institution in the form of the library.
Yeah, like a moving book box, right?
Yeah, that's
fantastic.
I love that idea. Meeting people where they are. So if you're at the farmer's market, you know, boom, now you're at the farmer's market and the library.
Yeah.
So what a great
way for the operator of the book bike there in Groton to engage people to talk about the livable communities grants. Like, oh, how did we get this bicycle? And then they suddenly just chat up AARP. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, no, that was one of five projects we funded this past year.
Oh,
and,
great.
Near and dear to my heart since, I also love bicycles.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 4 minutes or so left, so let's switch gears and let people know a few of the specifics and the caps on the grant and how they can apply.
Great. So best way to apply is to just go to our AARP Connecticut state website. So that's going to be aarp.org/CT. And right there on the homepage, it's off to the right-hand side, you're going to see a link that you can click on for the AARP Connecticut Livable Communities Grant Program.
Yeah, looking at it right now, I can attest that it's
so
there.
So am I. There it is.
Great.
But yeah, so click on that link, and then right on that page, we have the grant application, just a fillable PDF. We tried to keep it really easy and straightforward for folks. There's also a request for proposals that outlines some more specific details about the program. Important things to know, we're looking for 501c3 or c4 nonprofits and Connecticut government entities. Maximum amount for any single grant is $5,000. If you have an idea that you think you can fund with $700 or $2,000, great, submit it.
So that's important. That's an important point, Anna, is it doesn't have to get wedged into a $5,000 compartment in order to qualify or receive this this grant. If folks have an idea of window boxes on the senior center that are going to cost, as you said, $700 or $800, fill out the paperwork, right?
Exactly. Yep. We've seen, and funded applications in the past that have been for less than the maximum amount. And we've looked at it and said, you know what, this will have an impact on the community. And, it's been our pleasure to make some of those ideas happen.
Excellent. And is this something that is sort of vetted and granted at the state level? This is a kind of a self-contained Connecticut AARP program?
It is. So one of the things that I love about AARP is that we have a lot of great dedicated state level volunteers. So every year it's, me and a handful of our wonderful AARP Connecticut volunteers that look through these grants, and really think about which ones best speak to our mission and which ones we think are going to have the biggest impact in their community.
Very good. So these grants can involve affordable and accessible housing options for folks 50 and over, delivery of services for that same age group, creating safe and enjoyable public spaces for all ages with a focus on 50 plus. They can also involve initiatives around public transportation, fostering intergenerational and multicultural connections, financial security for low-income residents 50 and over, socialization and fostering community connections for older residents, community accessibility for disabled, and education and awareness about LGBTQ elders. So there's activism that's mixed in a little bit with these grants as well, which is great to hear. So Anna, if we can just wrap up once again with reminding people which website to go to learn more and apply, we will say farewell to you for this morning and thank you for your participation and information today.
Great. Yeah, just one more plug for that website, www.aarp.org/CT. All the information is linked right there on our homepage. We'd love to see your application.
Thanks. We want to thank Anna Dorghazi, who, along with Nora Duncan, has been such a great resource to all of our listeners here on the award-winning For the People for so many years. Best of luck on this year's round of the grants, and we'll be talking to you about some of the ones that you award once the program is over. So thanks for being on the program.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.